You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Right now, we're on top of a mountain in the Simi Hills.
3,000 feet above sea level at Sage Ranch Park. To be exact, it's on the border of LA and Ventura County, and it's surrounded by largely undeveloped land. A guy named John Luker describes the scene.
As I look around me, I see nothing but rolling, rolling hills, beautiful rock formations, a lot of chaparral. A lot of people think this is an industrial wasteland that's just filled with bubbling pools of ooze, and that's not correct whatsoever.
Pools of ooze, because this is a beautiful yet toxic waste dump, and it dates back to the space race of the mid-1900s. This was the site of an important aerronautics company called Rocketdyne, and the government has been talking about cleaning this land up since 2007. But well before it was used for rocket launches, this land was something else, a ceremonial site for local Native American tribes. And tribe leaders want to make sure the cleanup preserves Native American resources, such as wind caves and petroglyphs. Now, one tribe in particular has taken an outsized interest in the cleanup, whose reservation sits 100 miles away. KCRW's Catherine Barnes takes it from here.
Standing on that hilltop is one of the only ways to view the Rocketdyne site, a 2,800-acre property now called the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, SSFL for short. It's a proud and important part of California's space exploration industry, helping to send the first astronauts out of this atmosphere. 500,000 people live within 10 miles of the site, including Luker himself.
Yeah, I live down in Box Canyon. I live a mile from the front gate of SSFL. One of the reasons why I got involved in this is I heard all the hubbub and I was raising a family, and I really wanted to know if there was anything that was going to harm them.
By hubbub, he means fears of toxic pollutants trickling down from the site to nearby homes. See, from 1948 until 2006, the SSFL was a test facility for rockets. It was home to 10 nuclear reactors, 4 launch stands, and more than 30,000 rocket tests.
The location of the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, known by early employees as The Hill, proved to be an ideal spot. The geology of the site favored its use for testing.
This is a video produced by NASA, one of the operators that tested these rockets. What the video forgets to mention is the nuclear accidents that took place at the lab during its operation. Some experts believe a partial meltdown in 1959 was the worst nuclear disaster in U.S. history, surpassing the radiation released during the Three Mile Island accident 20 years later. The tests and meltdowns have scattered the property with chemicals like plutonium and strontium-90, chemicals that have moved downstream and created real cancer risks for nearby communities. In 2007, a federal-funded study found a 60% higher rate of certain cancers for those living close to the site. A few years later, the state of California reached an agreement with two of the land's owners and operators, NASA and the Department of Energy, to clean up the site. But that cleanup has barely begun, held up by disagreements and bureaucratic red tape. And as the polluters and state officials fight, a new player has entered the ring, the San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians. The tribe is based in San Ynez, a small rural town up north in Santa Barbara. Why would they care about a contaminated piece of property so far away? Well, they knew of at least one traditional ceremonial site on the land and knew there must be more.
We had the entire site resurveyed by archaeologists and Native American monitors. And it turned out that we found over 10 sites with cave drawings and paintings and over 100 cultural resource sites.
Sam Cohen is the tribe's lawyer. He says the Chumash people and other nearby Native tribes want to make sure those sites are protected. So in September, NASA asked the National Park Service to list the entire property on the National Register of Historic Places. Here's the chairman of the tribe, Kenneth Kahn.
The entire 2,800 acres was a sacred crossroads and solstice worship area for all three tribes. Given the rich history of the site, it remains a sacred site today.
This adds an important layer to the cleanup plan. How will the parties responsible for digging up and disposing of the toxic soil do so without disturbing the site's cultural heritage?
It's really relatively simple. You remove the contaminated soil, replace it with clean soil, and you revegetate.
That's Dan Hirsch. He's been leading the fight to get this site cleaned up for decades. He says protections for Native American resources already exist in the current 2010 cleanup agreement.
It's of course unlikely that a cave painting would be contaminated in the first place because no one built reactors or did rocket tests inside these small caves. But if there were some contamination and one couldn't remove the pollution without damaging the artifact, the agreement exempts it from cleanup.
He's worried that by putting the entire site on the historic registry, NASA is trying to strategically avoid cleaning it up to the fullest extent. Melissa Bumstead shares that worry. She thinks the tribe's involvement is a way for the polluters to circumvent the cleanup. She lives about 4 miles from the property and believes her young daughter's leukemia was caused by the radioactive and toxic chemicals abandoned there.
I think for every single cleanup advocate who's been working on this, we all became like physically depressed when we heard about this because it was clearly so cleverly planned. You know, they've been working on this for 4 years quietly, and it's a very politically savvy move.
Sam Cohen with the San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians rejects these accusations.
That's just fear-mongering, basically.
He says the tribe is committed to the cleanup. They just want to make sure Native American cultural resources are protected. Which brings us back to the polluters. This year, the Department of Energy began removing 10 of the most contaminated buildings at the Radioactive Materials Handling Facility complex, which was built in 1959 to handle nuclear fuel. Again, here's John Luker, who lives nearby.
This place was sort of the center of the nation for nuclear research at the time. There was a lot of sloppy handling there. It is very badly contaminated, and so are the drainages surrounding it. It's all going to have to get dug up.
But while some building removal is underway, the soil and groundwater cleanup has barely started. That's because there's so much disagreement on how to go about it. People like Melissa Bumstead and Dan Hirsch want the polluters to clean it up to background, meaning to the level it was at before they started building and testing on the land. That could cost an estimated $1.5 billion. But people like John Luker worry that cleaning it up to that extreme of a level would strip the land of its natural and cultural beauty. He says all the topsoil and everything growing on it would have to be removed.
What would this place look like if it were cleaned to background? Pretty much a big parking lot. 700 to 900 acres completely stripped of topsoil. They're going to take it all the way down to bedrock. Looks bad.
And could wild animals like mountain lions thrive in that type of habitat? Luker says no.
We're standing in the middle of the most important habitat linkage in California. All of the genetic diversity that goes into the Santa Monica Mountains comes through these hills and walks through the Rocketdyne Complex. If you destroyed what's up here in order to take out everything down to a background level, then the cats may not want to move through here anymore.
Instead of cleaning up to background, he wants to see the soil cleaned to recreational standards so people could safely visit the site but not work or live there. The San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians say they support any cleanup that remediates the property and protects sacred sites. Ultimately, it's in the hands of state regulators to decide what level of cleanup the polluters must do and then enforce it. Jared Blumenfeld is the director of Cal-EPA. He's standing firm on the full cleanup laid out in the 2010 agreement.
If parties are not willing to abide by a document that they signed, then we'll have to bring them to court to ensure that they do.
Lawsuits will further delay the cleanup. But in a multi-billion dollar battle filled with distrust that's been going on for more than a decade already, it's likely the only way. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. With a lot of LA's bars closed for the last 7 months, if you're having a cocktail in the evening, you're probably doing it at home. Well, back in March, just before LA's watering holes started shutting down, Eater LA's Mona Holmes was putting a story together for us to talk about a very cool thing happening in South LA. In an age of gentrification there, changing demographics, a vow to revive its history as a center of black-owned commerce, one bar at a time. And it's centered on a place called The Living Room, a meetup there called The Black Hour, where conversations flowed like whiskey and bourbon, and where people were trying to find a way to hold on to their neighborhood, its identity, its people. The COVID-19 pandemic has made a mess of things since then, but the story remains. And Mona is here now to talk about it. She's written about black-owned bars and how history meets the present in South LA. Hey, Mona.
Hello, Steve.
We've been talking about this story for 7 months.
We have. We have. It's kind of crazy how all this started. A very easy, simple story about the Black Hour, this amazing meetup by young professional blacks in Los Angeles at the Living Room.
The Living Room is in West Adams. Talk about what it's like and how you get in there.
Okay. Well, it's one of my favorite bars to get into because you'll walk right up there and there's all kinds of historic places and businesses, black-owned businesses around you. And then there's a doorbell in this very interesting 1970s architecture kind of facade. And that is the place where a huge amount of Black LA has gone to drink for decades, you know, and some people would describe it as a dive bar, but I consider them more historic places where black folks like myself can go and drink unbothered. And it's just a really, really great, great spot.
Can you talk to me about the word unbothered? What does that mean?
Well, this is an interesting topic. You know, I think as any woman can attest to, going into a bar solo sometimes can be, or even with friends, can be a little bit troublesome with people bothering you or other moments. But for this, it's more of a black space where folks who look like myself can go and drink. There's something to be said about being able to sit down at a bar where the bartenders are extraordinarily friendly, where some of the patrons, if I haven't been back in a while, they'll actually tap me on the shoulder and sound exactly as one of my aunties and say, where have you been? And, you know, there's a welcoming kind of vibe that I've never really experienced. I mean, truthfully, I don't really go out to bars much, even before COVID happened. I'm not really much of a bar drinker anymore. But when I did, places like the Cork or the Living Room would be a place that I would favor because it just feels very, very cozy and safe.
And now, as you mentioned, we have the pandemic. So many bars and restaurants in LA, the Living Room included, is struggling to stay afloat because of the shutdowns, because of the pandemic. Is there something that's particular to them and their customer base that makes it even harder to survive right now?
There is. I've found that after a couple of bar owners that I spoke to, with Susan Carnell, who owns The Living Room, and Derek Pipkin, who owns Pips on La Brea, the one common factor that's keeping their customer base away is COVID, because they know that COVID has affected Black and Latino communities more than anyone else. And so they're being very careful.
How many Black-owned bars are there in LA, Mona?
There's a lot. I mean, there are far more, I'd say, up until about 2000. But right now, the remaining are the Savoy, and that's in the middle of downtown Inglewood, the District in Crenshaw, the Living Room, West Adams. Pips on La Brea, unfortunately, is temporarily closed, and that is right around, I would say, like La Brea and Obama Boulevards. And then there's the French Quarter Creole Bar and Grill, and that is on Manchester near Western. And then there's one way in the in Bellflower, the Bottom Line Cocktail Lounge. And then there's the Parlor. And that one is not in South LA. That's on Melrose.
You and I and journalist Gil Robertson, we did a forum on Zoom a few weeks ago, which is fascinating because you guys talked a lot about the history of Black LA, especially in South Central, and the people who would go into these establishments, right? The famous people who would come to LA where maybe they didn't feel welcome in other parts of town, but they did in South Central. And some of, you know, I mean, we're talking some of the greats, right? Ella Fitzgerald and like great singers and entertainers. Talk a little bit about the history there.
Oh, okay. Well, you want history, you got it.
Oh, I want it. I want it.
I love, this has been the funnest part about diving into this story. I got to learn so much about probably LA's most prominent Black-owned bar, which was The Cork, which closed in September last year. It's a historic bar that opened up in the 1940s, and it was this massive gathering spot for Black locals, touring musicians, and celebrities like you mentioned. And these celebrities would visit because they faced active discrimination at other venues throughout Southern California. And so there was the Dunbar Hotel and Central Avenue Jazz that was kind of the center at all of this. But once things were closed and you know, they still wanted places to go. So you could have gone to The Cork and sat on the same bar stool that Cab Calloway or Sarah Vaughan sat on. So, and it was, I only picture myself back then because it just, I would imagine that it would have been amazing. And these folks would sit amongst everyone and just have a good old time because that's what they kind of needed, a safe space to just go and enjoy themselves.
These are some of the stories that I love the most, you know, history. You know, the old saying, Mona, dance with the one who brung you. And this is certainly a lot of places that brung you, especially in South Central LA. Mona Holmes, regular contributor here on Greater LA, reporter for Eater LA. Mona, as always, nice to have you on.
Thank you, Steve.
Glad you're here on KCRW's Greater LA. And let's wrap up today with California's existential crisis of voting and the question, why vote? I know, maybe that's a weird question right now to ask with so much attention focused on election stuff right now. And just under 2 million of us throughout the state of California already having done civic duty. But hold on for a second. Bear with me. Because there's a webpage where you've been able to ask questions about the election. By the way, that's at kcrw.com/election2020. And here's a question from there, someone who wanted to remain anonymous. Does it really matter if we vote? I mean, isn't the electoral vote still what's more important in each state? I'm assuming the electoral college is what this person is talking about. How can we get rid of this nationwide, and why is it so? Well, as it happens, fellow Californian and New York Times columnist Farhad Manju wrote his column this week on that very subject, and he's here now to talk about it. Farhad, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks. Good to be here.
You had a column where you say every 2 years when it's time to vote in national elections, you rip open the packet with a sense of sacred, nerdy seriousness, but then you end up bitter and angry. What does that mean? And how would you answer the question from our anonymous listener?
Well, I can see why your anonymous listener asked it, because I wonder the same thing every 2 years. You know, we in California were the largest state. We have 40 million people, but you kind of look at the way that the presidential race goes, or, you know, the Supreme Court nomination, and we really don't have much of a say. One of the reasons we don't have much of a say is because of the Electoral College. And, you know, like, it doesn't really matter how much a winning candidate wins by, because the Electoral College is winner take all. So For example, Hillary Clinton in 2016 won California by 4 million votes, and she also won the national popular vote. So, you know, a lot of those votes came from California, but they were essentially ignored because we have an electoral system that says it's much more important to get votes currently in the Midwest.
You also had President Trump claiming that 3 million of those votes in California were from illegal immigrants, were illegal votes. So there was that claim.
Without any evidence.
There were also people who were saying the 49 other states voted in the majority for President Trump, and so somehow that makes California's votes moot.
Right. I mean, the thing is, you know, the people of California are Americans, and it has always struck me as just bizarre and completely unfair that our vote counts less than others, and it counts less because, you know, because of the Electoral College. It just doesn't matter if you get over and above your opponent in the state, and so there's just millions of votes cast here that are essentially wasted. They don't really help the winning candidate.
Republicans, Farhad, have only won one popular vote in a presidential election since 1988, only one in 32 years. That's in 2004 when George W. Bush won re-election by about 2.5 million votes. Do we have representative democracy, and is that what it's supposed to be? Is that what you think the founding fathers of this country wanted it to be?
Well, this argument has gone on for a long time, and you know, there were enormous compromises that the founding fathers made to set up the way that we vote. I mean, one of them was, a big part of it had to do with slavery. They, of course, didn't allow everybody to vote. And so, you know, I would imagine that the kind of popular vote that we're talking about where everyone has a say is not what they wanted. But, you know, we have a modern conception essentially of one person, one vote. The Supreme Court has suggested that. It is sort of what we think of as democracy. And it just does not stand sort of in the modern day. Even if that's how they wanted to set it up, I think it's just sort of facially unfair. And it's sort of even, you know, more unfair when you consider the power that the United States Senate has, and we just don't have a lot of voice there at all. You know, we get two senators, and Wyoming, which has, you know, 600,000 people, gets two senators, and that's just two senators for 40 million people versus two senators for 600,000 is just profoundly unfair.
Well, and how it was originally set up in the founding days were the senators were elected by state legislatures, right? The states sent the senators.
Right. Now we have direct election of senators. And so, you know, it's a much more obvious kind of democratic link there. And so it just seems like we're getting shut out of the national process. I mean, the Senate is the body that decides who gets on the Supreme Court, and half, after the latest nominee is confirmed, half of those justices will have been chosen by senators that essentially represented a minority of Americans, not the majority that lives in basically all the blue states.
Do you see the system changing, Farhad? I mean, how should it work?
I mean,
the Republic has evolved, right?
It has. And, you know, I think there are ways you can think about compromising. I read this column, and lots of people suggested many different kind of ways to count our votes in a way that kind of balances out power regionally and between different states. And I would be open to more compromise, but I think the most obvious way for picking a president is the person who gets the most votes wins. There's an effort called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which basically a bunch of states have signed a guarantee that if the majority of states signs up to this, then everyone would kind of obey the popular vote. But I don't know if that's going to happen. And, you know, changing any of these rules requires either constitutional change or just big agreements between states. It's hard to see how it will change. Yeah.
There's so much there. Farhad Manjoo, it's certainly an interesting topic to talk about, obviously, since we're in election season right now. And who knows what's going to happen on November 3rd or beyond. But we're going to anxiously await and hopefully get through it. Farhad Manjoo, New York Times columnist and California voter. Farhad, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
You bet. Well, there is power in numbers, whether it be an election or whether it be a fundraiser for KCRW. When we come together, we can create a better future. With the dollars that you give to this radio station, think about the things that we do every day, whether that be the news that you get on Morning Edition with Cherry Glazer or Afternoons with Larry Perel, Madeline Brand and Press Play. Could be the music that you enjoy, that I enjoy every day with Ann Lid and Morning Becomes Eclectic and our slew of disc jockeys, talented disc jockeys at this radio station. If it's something that's important to you, give now at kcrw.com/give. Today only, support KCRW, you'll automatically be entered to win a brand new 13-inch MacBook Pro Air. Man, that's exciting stuff too. And you know you'll be doing some great stuff for this radio station and for the community as well. kcrw.com/give. Thanks for being with us today. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for lending us your ears and your attention. Don't forget to vote. Have a great night.